From Jefferson Public Radio at Southern Oregon University, this is the Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Coming up after the news, what to do next in Syria, if anything. The American mood at the moment is one of decidedly mixed feelings. With diplomacy the favorite approach of the moment, the White House and Congress are hanging back on the war talk. And that's just fine by Leah Bolger. She's a member and past national president of the group Veterans for Peace. We'll also visit with Dr. Samer Aboud from Arcadia University. He also serves as a fellow at the Center for Syrian Studies in Scotland. So we'll learn a thing or two about the country our country's leaders are thinking of invading, what that might do to Syria itself, and the effect it might have on the body politic here in the United States. Samer Aboud, Leah Bolger, strategies for Syria, and your phone calls and emails ahead on the Jefferson Exchange. First, the news of the hour. You're listening to the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio, broadcasting live weekday mornings and rebroadcasting weekday evenings on radio stations serving California and Oregon, and found online as well at jeffexchange.org. It is Thursday, September 12, 2013. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. In this hour, what should be the next step on Syria? Or is the next move simply not taking any step at all? You'll hear from an anti-war demonstrator and a Syria expert about the choices that face the United States. And you can join our discussion on the exchange. You'll hear the phone numbers and the email address shortly. First, a weather forecast for the region from Jefferson Exchange producer Charlotte Duran.
On the Northern California coast today, a chance of drizzle and areas of fog and mostly cloudy with a high near 64. In Redding and Red Bluff, sunny and hot with a high near 96. In Yreka, mostly sunny and hot with a high near 96. In Weed and Mount Shasta, a slight chance of showers and thunderstorms, mostly sunny with a high near 90. On the Southern Oregon coast, areas of fog and mostly cloudy with a high near 70. In the Klamath Basin, mostly sunny with a high near 89. In Grants Pass, Medford, and Ashland, mostly sunny and hot with a high near 98. On the Southern Oregon Cascades and Siskiyous, a slight chance of showers and thunderstorms and mostly sunny with a high near 81. In Roseburg and the Umpqua Basin, patchy fog and cloudy, then gradually becoming mostly sunny with a high near 89. And in Eugene and Springfield today, patchy fog and partly sunny with a high near 85.
Well, the presence of thunderstorms in the region, not necessarily a good thing, obviously, because we still have very hot and dry conditions in abundance. The temperatures will taper just a bit over the course of the next couple of days and then begin to fall a bit more sharply. But that is still a couple of days off. Some moisture, therefore some instability, therefore possible thunderstorms over the course of the next few days, increasing as we get closer to the weekend. Clover Fire on the California side, South Shasta County and the Happy Valley area. The Cal Fire update of just a little bit ago, 68 homes destroyed completely, 5 damaged, 1 death at this point, 7,993 acres torched, and at 65% containment. So they are getting a handle on it. They are reopening some roads in the Happy Valley and Igo areas, but it's a bit of a mess in there still. So we'll keep you posted on that. Thanks for listening to us on the Jefferson Exchange today. We're always glad for your time and attention. And if you'd like to take part in our conversations on the exchange, feel free. Phone numbers 800-838-3760 anywhere in the listening area. In the Rogue Valley, 541-552-6782. Or send emails to jx@jeffnet.org. The civil war that is tearing Syria apart is strangely uniting far-flung elements of American political thought. Just yesterday, September 11th, self-described liberals and people connected to the conservative Tea Party movement joined forces to march in Medford against the United States attacking Syria. The prospect of an attack appears to be on the back burner at the moment. On the front burner is a diplomatic effort to put Syria's chemical weapons in the hands of international authorities. That has not yet happened. Question becomes, then, what should be the next step? Our guests this hour come at this from different angles. Leah Bolger is member and past national president of the group Veterans for Peace. Leah, thank you for joining us.
Good morning.
Good to have you here. And Samer Aboud is assistant professor of history and international studies at Arcadia University in Pennsylvania. He is also a fellow at the Center for Syrian Studies in St. Andrews, Scotland. Samer, thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me.
You've done a great deal of study and writing on Syria. Have you been to Syria much yourself?
Yeah, actually, I spent considerable time between 2003 and 2011. I was actually there 2010. The last time I was there was a few months before the revolution started, and I did my doctoral research in there during that time.
Interesting. You call it a revolution and not a civil war. Is there much of a distinction in your mind?
There is. I certainly think that this began as a revolution, and I'm certainly hoping that it will end with many of the revolutionary goals realized by the protesters. I do think that it has taken on the form of a civil war, as many elements of the opposition have been militarized. But I think that here in the West, especially in the United States, we have turned our attention to the militarized opposition at the expense of seeing what's happening with the nonviolent opposition that's occurring on the ground.
Nonviolent opposition. I mean, there are still some elements who want regime change, but they're not actually shooting for it.
Absolutely, absolutely, and they remain very strong. That's one element of the groups that I'm talking about. A second is the many of the local committees within the areas that are no longer under direct regime control that have come together to run schools, hospitals, that are things like that, that are taking on the serious responsibilities of governing Syria. And I think that those people are working towards the goals of the revolution, which is a more transparent system, a more democratic system, a system that is free of the kind of collective punishment and violence that we're seeing the regime inflict on the people right now.
And Leah Bolger, I want to come to you to tell us about you and your work with Veterans for Peace.
Well, I'm a retired naval commander. I've spent 20 years on active duty, and since my retirement, I've become progressively more involved in anti-war work. I approach this issue of the Syria conflict as an anti-war activist, and not just opposed to war, but also really trying to promote adherence to international law and international values and norms. And I see the situation as the U.S. being very hypocritical in the policies that it's proposing and supporting and what has been our own transgressions in the past. But I would like to underline what Dr. Abboud said about this revolution starting as a follow-on to the Arab Spring and what happened in Tunisia and in Egypt, which was nonviolent. And we certainly want to support the people of Syria who are trying to create a more humanitarian, more egalitarian, more democratic government and society in which to live. And I think that has been completely overshadowed by this militarism of the conflict.
But you say that the United States is being hypocritical. In what sense, or senses, plural?
Well, we ourselves are not a party to the International Criminal Court, and I think that's probably the primary reason why we haven't insisted that that this breach of the chemical weapons ban treaty be pursued through judicial channels. Which is exactly what should happen, and that's what the Chemical Ban Treaty says, that it should be, referred to the International Criminal Court. It is not, nowhere in international law does it say that if some country does something bad or transgresses, that the United States should attack them militarily. When I say we're hypocritical, is that we have many times and are still using today weapons that are not approved by the international community. We're killing people every day with drone attacks. Depleted uranium has had horrific consequences in Iraq and Fallujah particularly. We started using depleted uranium years and years ago. There are many people suffering from the first Gulf War in 1991. Agent Orange, napalm, white phosphorus. We use white phosphorus. Israel uses white phosphorus. We don't raise any think about that. But these are violations of international norms. We haven't even signed on to the International Landmine Ban Treaty, which Jody Williams won the Nobel Peace Prize for, because we think that will endanger our own troops. So we're we don't follow international norms when we don't feel like it suits us. And so to hold serious feet to the fire and say, oh, you violate an international norm, it's really hypocritical and a double standard. I think it's almost laughable.
Much more to talk about with our guests about the situation in Syria and how the United States approaches it, or whether the United States should walk away and leave it to somebody else. We'll raise that question when we come back. We're talking to Leah Bolger, member and past national president of Veterans for Peace and a retired commander from the Navy. Samer Aboud is assistant professor of history and international studies at Arcadia University in Pennsylvania and a Syria expert. We'll come back and talk more with Dr. Aboud and Commander Bolger, retired, and you when we return to the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 20. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on Jefferson Public Radio's News and Information Service, I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We're talking today about Syria and what American options are with a couple of guests from different perspectives on this issue. Leah Bolger is member and past national president of the group Veterans for Peace. She's a retired commander from the U.S. Navy. Dr. Samer Aboud is assistant professor of history and international studies at Arcadia University in Pennsylvania and a Syria expert. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange as we talk about options to take or not to take, or just to walk away completely if that's what you think we should be doing. Our phone number is on the Jefferson Exchange, 800-838-3760, anywhere in the listening area. Our Rogue Valley local number, 541-552-6782. Email address is jx@jeffnet.org. Leah Bolger, I want to come back to you because we're talking about what you see as the hypocritical actions of the United States, insisting upon compliance, Syria's compliance to international law governing use of chemical weapons, when the United States hasn't even signed some particular agreements that other countries are party to about such dangerous weapons. The International Criminal Court, though, you brought up here about why not go there. Is it not likely, do you think, that if the International Criminal Court were to make any finding against Syria, that Bashar Assad would simply laugh it off?
Well, we don't know. We don't know what would happen. But what it would say is that the whole international community would be putting pressure and be making a judgment, and that it wouldn't be one rogue nation who takes it into their own hands, to be a judge and jury and punishment, enforcer. So, we don't know how President Assad would react to an incrimination. And Syria is also not a party to the ICC, so very well might say that it's not valid. He might ignore it. We don't know what would happen, but I think that would be the way to go instead of the United States continuing to violate international law by militarily punishing a country, which would be itself a violation of international law if it were done without authorization from the United Nations. So, we hail all this adherence to international law, and then we flout it whenever we feel like it's in our best interest.
Dr. Samer Aboud, what are some essential things we all need to know just as starting points for understanding Syria?
Oh, that's a tough question. it was once said about Lebanon that if you understand it, it was badly explained to you. And I think the same applies to Syria. I think I'd just like to applaud the great points that Leah brought up first. But in terms of Syria, what we need to understand is that the overwhelming majority of the population has only ever known the authoritarian rule of Bashar al-Assad and his father, who took power in 1970. That's one thing to know, that there's been emergency rule for more than 40 years in the country. There's been a state of emergency during that time. High levels of individual and collective repression that occurred during that period within the country. But more important factors that were behind the cause of the revolution were not just the political repression that occurred, but the material and economic conditions that people had been experiencing right before the revolution. There were dozens of villages in agricultural areas, for example, that had been depopulated, and people were forced to migrate from these areas into the urban peripheries, you know, in informal housing, in slums, things like that. The economy was quite stagnant, and much of the wealth that was being created in the 10 to 15 years before the conflict was concentrated into the hands of a very small elite that were directly connected to the power, to regime power. And so you had a lot of economic dissatisfaction that corresponded to political repression. And with the Arab revolutions that began in Tunisia and Egypt, there was a small opening, and it was mostly, I mean, look where the revolutions started, were mostly in the rural, non-urban areas, and eventually made their way into the peripheries of Damascus and Aleppo and the major population centers of Syria. So I think that we need to keep in mind that this revolution was not sectarian, which some people would like us to believe. It is a revolution grounded in all of the conditions that every revolution around the world has been grounded in, which is, you know, mostly material dislocation, political dissatisfaction, and in access to an economic and political system that favored a very small elite at the expense of the majority of the population.
But even if a fight starts not as a sectarian one, when things begin to break down in civil society and more people get shot all the time, does it tend to move along towards sectarian lines? People tend to cluster with their tribes, their groups, their religions?
Certainly it has taken on a sectarian element, and we can't deny that. But I think that we have to reject the idea that there are communities that are only, for example, the minority communities are 100% supporting the regime, or the Sunni majority are 100% behind the rebels. The reality is a bit more complicated than that. But you're certainly right that people back themselves into the safe corners, if you will, of their sectarian or of their identities. Otherwise, the majority of urban Sunnis, for example, I shouldn't say the majority, but a significant portion, have continued to back the regime, mostly because they haven't been attracted to the rebels. They also haven't been attracted to the militarization of the revolution. So one of the phenomena, I think, that's emerging within Syria is a rejection both of the regime and of the militarized rebels. And that kind of third nuanced path is not a sectarian path, is not a sectarian identity, but one that is more responsive to the immediate needs on the ground, which are security, safety. And that, of course, cuts across sectarian lines. That said, there are groups on the ground, whether it's from the regime or whether it's from the rebel side, and this includes the al-Qaeda types that have infiltrated the ranks of the rebels or have taken on some of the fighting, who have an interest, an active interest in promoting this as a sectarian conflict.
You talked about the nonviolent opponents of the government who are attempting to do some of the work of governing in areas that that the rebels hold. I just wonder, though, in an area that hasn't had civil rule in more than 40 years, it sounds like it's a difficult thing to build institutions, as was the case in Iraq in the vacuum after Saddam Hussein, to build institutions when one person had autocratic rule for so long.
Absolutely. And you have a complete breakdown of regime institutions in the liberated areas. They're simply not functioning. But what's happened, remarkably, is that many of the people who are in these institutions, whether it's the engineers or the bureaucrats, is that they have put themselves at the service of governance on the local level. So they're still oftentimes doing the work that they were doing before, just to, you know, just to make sure that electricity or water, any services that are still available, are up and running. I read a statistic the other day that more than 60% of Syria's public hospitals are inoperable, that there's nobody in there, they're not working. So this is, you know, this awful, monumental task ahead of the people on the ground, but they're still putting their efforts towards trying to create systems of distribution and systems where people can still acquire services. So take schools, for example. Schools are an excellent example where teachers who some are and some are not being paid by the government anymore, public school teachers, parents, people in the community are coming together and making sure that children especially in the rural areas, still have schools to go to, are still being taught, are still given exams, things like that. And I think to perhaps preempt a question about what the United States can do or what they could have done, is that the United States, this administration, completely ignored those structures on the ground, completely ignored them, and did not bother in any way, shape, or form to funnel resources to those groups on the ground that were not engaging in the kind of violence that has turned off this administration.
This sounds similar to what happened at the end of the movie Charlie Wilson's War, which, of course, is based on a true story, where once the fighting was over, there was no particular enthusiasm for doing things like building schools.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. But one of the things we need to keep in mind in the Syrian case is that the violence and the nonviolence protests, these governance things that we're talking about, are occurring on very local levels. So the violence is very localized, which is why you don't, why it feels and smells and looks like a traditional civil war, and there's this kind of inertia. But the governance is happening, you know, in communities. It's not happening on provincial scales, on, you know, wider cities. People are just trying to make ends meet. And what happens to those, they need to be strengthened. They need to be given some sort of material support so that society doesn't completely collapse under the weight of this conflict.
We're talking about options in Syria for the United States, or perhaps whether the United States should not even have any options because it shouldn't be over there at all. Samer Aboud is Assistant Professor of History and International Studies at Arcadia University in Pennsylvania. We're also joined by Leah Bolger, member and past national president of the group Veterans for Peace. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange. Phone number is 800-838-3760, anywhere in the listening area. In the Rogue Valley, 541-552-6782. Email address jx@jeffnet.org. Here is MJ in Eugene. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Yeah, thank you for taking my call. Yeah, I have a comment first. You know, how this administration is really hypocrite. They let the Saudi army invade Bahrain, and Bahrain is a small island in the Persian Gulf or the Arabian Gulf, 2.5 years ago, when they have their revolution, 14th February revolution against the king, which they've been fighting him over 50 years now. They let the army enter Bahrain. We have the 5th fleet, the biggest base in the Middle East, in Bahrain. They let the Saudi come in and invade Bahrain. So far, they kill 150 persons, men and women and children. We have over 2,000 in jail, and we have 161 kids in jail right now. The school started, and the United States did not say anything. Secondly, about the gas, we sold the gas to Saddam Hussein. He used it against the Iranians. We have over 1 million persons suffering from that in Iran. And then he used it in Halabja, and we did not say anything until he threatened Israel. Then we interfered. About Syria, Iran over 6 months ago told the United States that there is a gas, the rubble has a gas, which I don't call them a rubble because most of them missionaries paid from Saudi Arabia and United Arab Emirates and Qatar and United States, trained them in Turkey and in Jordan, and then send them to Syria to fight. They're from Chechnya, Qatar, United Arab Emirates, Libya, Jordan, all over the world. And they get paid, Europe, all they get paid by country.
All right, so your point is that the United States intervenes in lots of cases or doesn't intervene in lots of cases, and therefore why should it in Syria?
Yeah, why? Only because Syria, if they have this gas, the only thing is...
All right, MJ, I'm going to stop you here because it's really, really hard to understand you with your cell phone connection. I'm sorry, but your phone is just too poor in quality to want to go on here. But we have the gist of what you're talking about here. And Leah Bolger, I think this is along the lines of what you're saying, is that we seem to be picking and choosing the places we go into without a real consistent thread.
Right, exactly. You know, he mentioned Bahrain. You know, the reason we haven't said anything about Bahrain is because they let us host the 5th Fleet there. We have American ships that are ported out of Bahrain. And it's a perfect, you know, geographic location. We want to have a military presence. When I say we, I mean our government. I don't mean you and me. So, yes, we're very hypocritical. We don't follow the standards that we say we want to impose on we want everyone else to follow. We don't hold Israel to the same standards either. You know, we're up in arms about Iran possibly pursuing a nuclear weapon. But Israel has several hundred nuclear weapons. They are not a party to the Non-Proliferation Treaty, the NPT. They've never had IAEA inspectors in Israel. They don't even admit that they own nuclear weapons. But we are ready to go to war with Iran because they might perhaps want to pursue nuclear weapons. They have every right to do that. We protect Israel in the same way that we denounce Russia for protecting Syria. In the UN, American congressmen have just denounced Russia for vetoing anything to do with Syria. We've vetoed dozens of resolutions about Israel. So, you know, yes, we're very have a very, very hypocritical policy, double standards. Only when they serve the U.S. interest do we seek to enforce them.
Is there anything in the boilerplate of Veterans for Peace, charter, mission statement, anything that indicates any circumstances in which Veterans for Peace would advocate military action?
No. Well, in self-defense, I would say. What we say is that based on our experience as military veterans, we have learned that war is not the answer, that war creates more problems, and that violence begets violence. And so some of us are pacifists. Some of us, most of us, I would say, are not. And if we were attacked on the street, we would probably fight back. If this country were physically attacked by another nation, in a conventional type of war, we would feel, that was, I think most of us would feel like it would be our right to defend ourselves. But that's what we would propose the United States have, is a self-defense force, not a global military that has outreach in virtually every country in the world. We have military people in over 100 nations. We have thousands of military facilities. And, you know, we can't even imagine what that would be like to have another country's military base. Can you imagine, if Germany decided they wanted to have a base or Iranian ships were cruising in the Gulf of Mexico? We wouldn't have that. So Veterans for Peace says that our ultimate purpose is to abolish war as an instrument of national policy. And so I even the World War II, which everybody throws up as a just war, there are people in Veterans for Peace would say, we really didn't try nonviolent tactics. We don't know what might have happened had we tried that. And we certainly can't justify a firebombing, the nuclear bombing of civilian cities, and the hundreds and thousands of people, civilians who were killed in that war by our hand. So, Veterans for Peace really, it would be hard for us to come up with an instance where you could say, yes, we think that military force is the right attack.
Samara Boud, we're going to hit a break in about a minute, so the answer can't be terribly long, but I just wonder if you can give us an idea of what the people who are fighting the regime in Syria want from the United States, if they are not the non-violent elements I'm talking about here.
Well, I think at the very least they want the United States to place more political pressure and to show more of a political interest in the humanitarian catastrophe. I think there are very real material needs that the refugees and the internally displaced people need. I think there are other methods of support that the United States could have offered from the beginning of this revolution. This support could have been as minimal as training and organizing to providing a material nonviolent support for people to organize themselves on the ground ground. Let's not forget that there was tremendous pressure on the regime from the nonviolent elements of this revolution, and perhaps a push, a show of support. All these things that do not require the military resources of the United States or other countries could have perhaps pushed them over the edge or given them the kinds of support and energy that they would have needed to accomplish their goal of overthrowing the regime.
All right. Back from a break in just a moment with Samer Aboud and Leah Bulger and your phone calls and emails. It's the final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange on Jefferson Public Radio's News and Information Service. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We're talking about U.S. options in Syria and perhaps whether there even should be options for Syria. While the United States hangs back from the concept of a military attack and considers diplomatic moves, our guests today, Leah Bulger, member and past national president of the group Veterans for Peace. We're also joined by Dr. Samer Aboud, assistant professor of history and international studies at Arcadia University in Pennsylvania, considered a Syria expert. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange at 800-838-3760. That's anywhere in our listening area. Our Rogue Valley local number, 541-552-6782, or by email, jx@jeffnet.org. Ralph in Mendocino, thank you for waiting. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Yes, I'll try to be succinct. Since I'm using my cell phone with time limit per month, I'll be brief.
Up against the clock.
I wish to point out, firstly, that apparently in today's San Francisco Chronicle, Nancy Pelosi has received a nice large gift from IPAC, the Israeli-American Political Action Committee, for support of a war in Syria. And then also it reported that the United States is sharing, NSA is sharing data with Israeli secret forces, and also pointing out the paradox that Pollard is still in prison for having done so voluntarily. And I only think to suggest that the justification that the United States, for its own self-protection, needs to invade Syria is absurd, and that the United States has been pursuing a foreign policy for Israel for too long. And The Guardian, in a recent message I received from a friend in Europe, indicates that half of the United States vetoes in the Security Council have been rescuing Israel from world condemnation. And I'll take your reply on the air.
All right. Thank you, Ralph, for the call. Either Leah or Samer want to take that one?
Leah, would you like to?
Oh, well, I would just say that, you know, the caller, Ralph, didn't seem to have any questions. He just sort of reinforced several points that we had both made. I agree with everything you said.
No, go ahead, Samer.
Oh, no, I was just going to say that I believe the recent foreign policy of the United States, I mean, of course, it is completely clouded by the Israeli factor, completely 100%. But there are other factors as well that have begun to play into this in recent years, and that's the Iranian factor, the perceived Iranian factor. And there's this almost perfect, if you will, alliance from the perspective of U.S. foreign policy of groups and states within the region who are acquiescent, if you will, to Israeli supremacy, and that includes groups and states who are not formal allies, such as Saudi Arabia, Qatar, other countries, former allies with Israel, that is. And on the other side, you know, Iran and Syria and Hezbollah and these groups that are perceived by the U.S. foreign policy establishment as being misfits in a region that should be dominated by the Israelis. And I certainly think that both the Israeli factor and the kind of fear, if you will, of the Iranian factor have largely determined U.S. foreign policy.
Samer Aboud, you co-wrote the recent book Rethinking Hezbollah. Does anything the United States does in the region strengthen Hezbollah and, by extension, Iran?
Not really. I mean, to some degree, the presence of the United States and its strong support for Israel guarantees the continuity of a discourse from Hezbollah, from Iran, that the United States is simply acting a kind of modern colonial power and is able to penetrate the region through its support for Israel. So whenever there are bombings in Lebanon, for example, there was a recent bombing in the southern suburbs of Beirut. There are signs that come up that say made in USA. And this started in the 1980s, whether or not the United States is actually responsible or not, but they are seen as certainly being the material support for Israel that contributes to a lot of the violence that is happening in Lebanon. So this, to some degree, plays into the way in which Hezbollah and Iran and their foreign policy establishments see the region as well.
Let us take another call. Mike in Arcata, thank you for waiting. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Thanks a lot. Really, thank you for this kind of discussion. I feel like we need more and more and more of this kind of thing aired for people involved in. But one of the things I noticed as they were talking about the run-up to this was justifying an act of violence, of a military response against Syria because of crimes against humanity. And I'm wondering about the way that the American government seems to run away from using the international courts to decide these kind of things. And then over the last few days, they've, you know, 9/11 came by, and they were talking about the significance of that in Chile, where Nixon and Kissinger, who is now considered an elder statesman by many of the media, and Kissinger is still around and was highly involved in the overthrow of Allende and the emplacement of the CIA in that country and many others, where they ran death squads and torture schools, and this is our government, folks. So we're doing it again, and I really hope that the American public will just say no, this is, you know, certainly it's horrendous what is happening, but we should not be just default military response to everything that we allow to engage at this level, and then say, oh, well, we must fire cruise missiles at $100 million per launch or whatever it may be. And the wars are not helpful to the people. They are helpful to the wealthy. They're not helpful to the people, either this country or any other country where we've used these kind of tactics. So.
All right, Mike, thanks for the call. I very much appreciate you joining the conversation today. Leah Bolger, you must be heartened, I would think, at Veterans for Peace, at the strength of opposition to the war then, or to the concept of an attack on Syria. I don't want to call it a war, per se.
Right, yes, well, absolutely. I think in the past, when we ask people to call their congressmen, you know, people just sort of shrug and say, oh, it doesn't do any good. And it appears that, you know, the huge response by the American public has had an effect. We have been heard, and we have had a role to play. I would reiterate, though, what what the other caller mentioned about AIPAC and the lobbyists have a tremendous hold on our government and had, you know, probably at least as much power as the American citizen does on making these decisions. I also think that, you know, in this case, it worked out well for anti-war activists, but I think there are a number of partisan politicians who will vote against anything that President Obama wants just because they are obstructionists. So I'm glad in this case it's working the way I want it to, but I don't think we can count on this as a signal that the American public in general has turned anti-war. I think we still need a lot more education. We need to get away from this fear baiting that Dr. Boob mentioned, that, you know, that we are taught to be afraid that countries, you know, Iran is out to get us and is our enemy. But the fact is that we could accomplish so much more through the legal system and through humanitarian channels. The cost that we spent, like on one cruise missile, millions of dollars, and we could be spending that money to help refugees. I think it's ironic that, you know, now we have millions of refugees fleeing Syria. We created millions of refugees when we attacked Iraq.
Who went into Syria.
Mm-hmm. It moved into Syria and Jordan. And so now, you know, it's that's where we could really influence public opinion and world opinion, is by helping people. And, you know, it's a sorry shame that our money, our tax dollars, are being used to spin to harm people instead of help people.
Sam Rabu, do I hear you trying to get in here?
Yeah, no, I want to agree with Leah wholeheartedly, but just to emphasize that from the very beginning of this conflict, that when the administration spoke publicly about this, is that they took their only options to be intervention or not intervention, and they had a whole host of other options that could have centralized and taken as their principal concern not the overthrow or not of the regime, but alleviating the humanitarian crisis, of strengthening local committees on the ground, local actors on the ground. But instead, what they've done, and I think this is why this administration is in the mess that they're in now. I mean, they've painted themselves into a corner by saying we're not going to do anything, but only putting the options of military attack or not military attack on the table. They have not had a dynamic response to what's happened in Syria, and I think that dynamic response could have started first and foremost by trying to alleviate this awful, awful humanitarian catastrophe that has happened within the country and also within the region. I mean, the displacement of people goes way back, even almost before the Iraq conflict. So the United States could have, this was an opportunity where it could have placed humanitarian interests above or at least on parallel with other interests, and it failed miserably to do so.
Another call here, Marilee in Applegate. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Samer Abood and Leah Bolger.
Hi. I'm just a very confused individual sometimes, and when I read about Syria, or I just read a book about Sudan, and one of the things they said numerous times is a lot of Americans don't even know or care what's going on, really. And in actuality, I guess what I want to ask is, in order to do humanitarian aid, one country does it alone or a whole group of countries do it together, I don't know how you can do humanitarian aid well in a civil war. Can you kind of give me some idea how we could have gone in at the beginning and done that?
All right. Thanks for the question, Marilee. So, Sam, you want to take that one on?
Sure. That's actually a really good question. Well, there are two ways in which resources, or two areas where resources could have been directed. They could have been directed to internal groups. And we know that there are many groups in Lebanon, in Turkey, in Jordan. These are non-affiliated, non-political groups that are working strictly to alleviate humanitarian crises. The other thing is that support could have been given to the groups on the ground, whether the organs of international organizations or non-governmental organizations that are working in the refugee camps in Turkey, Lebanon, and Jordan. But this, again, gets clouded by this very narrow way that the U.S. foreign policy establishment sees the Middle East. So I'll give you one example. There was one point in this conflict where the number of refugees in Lebanon was higher than the number of refugees in Turkey. But the United States and many Western allies had refused to funnel any resources or money into Lebanon, but had done so into Turkey, and had actually pledged to offer money to the Turkish government to support them with the refugee crisis. Now, the rationale for not giving money to Lebanon was that they were worried that the money could fall into the hands of Hezbollah. Now, this puts geopolitical strategic concerns above humanitarian ones. There were organizations on the ground that the United States was a part of. I mean, United Nations organs that were there working on the ground in Lebanon, and the United States actively undermined their ability. So any humanitarian response could have started at a very basic level of supporting the distribution of resources to people on the ground and skipping over, if you will, the geopolitical situation.
I can fit in one more email here. This comes from Eric in Ashland. He says, I just want to express my admiration and support for everything Leah Bolger said about the inconsistency of the U.S. foreign policies and military actions, especially our blind support of nuclear-armed Israel and turning a blind eye to torture and killing of citizens in Bahrain. Bravo. Does her group have a website? And it does it not, Leah?
Yes, indeed. Veteransforpeace.org.
Okay, that's
I don't know where he... What city is he from?
From Ashland, Oregon.
Yeah, there's a chapter of Veterans for Peace, chapter 156, there in the Rogue Valley.
All right. And you're actually in Corvallis yourself, aren't you, Leah?
Indeed. That's
all right. I want to thank you both for joining us today. Leah Bolger is member and past national president of Veterans for Peace and a veteran of the U.S. Navy, retired now. Samer Aboud is assistant professor of history and international studies at Arcadia University in Pennsylvania, also fellow at the Center for Syrian Studies in St. Andrews, Scotland. Thank you both for joining us today on the Jefferson Exchange.
Thank you so much for having me.
Very good to have you. I want to let you know about a special event coming up involving Jefferson Public Radio for our listeners in Humboldt County and potentially Mendocino County as well. The JPR Foundation Board will be meeting in Eureka on Friday, September 20th. There'll be a public reception at 7 o'clock at the Eureka Theater in Eureka on the evening of September 20th. You'll have the opportunity to learn about current and future JPR activities and ask questions of JPR staff and members of the JPR Foundation Board of Directors. That's Friday evening, September 20th at 7 at the Eureka Theater. You can call us for more information at 541-552-6301. And that'll do it for today's Jefferson Exchange. Tomorrow at 8 o'clock, we'll talk to Bob Hunter at the Mail Tribune. He's the editor, about new owners for the Mail Tribune and the Ashland Daily Tidings. We'll talk to the folks at the Center for Nonprofit Legal Services in Jackson County about what they do. Then we'll talk to the author of Knocking on Heaven's Door, The Path to a Better Way of Death. That's all tomorrow on the Jefferson Exchange. Our producer is Charlotte Dern. Our student assistant is Reed Newland. Off this week, I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Please join us again tomorrow at 8 for another edition of the Jefferson Exchange here on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. And have a great day.